Well, hey everyone, me again. Well, we are starting a new series today about friendship. And I think what we're going to all discover over the next several weeks is that friendship has a lot more to do with actually our discipleship to Jesus than maybe we've ever thought. One of the most moving pictures of friendship in the whole Bible is the story in the Old Testament of David and Jonathan. And so just to set up the scene, Saul, King Saul, was the king at the time. Jonathan is his son, which means in this political system, Jonathan is the would-be heir apparent to the throne of Israel, except God had chosen someone else. The prophet Samuel had anointed David, and this is key, no relation to Saul, to be the next king. Now, that should make David like Jonathan's enemy number one, because the one person standing between him and the throne is David, a threat to eliminate. But that's not what Jonathan does. Instead, Jonathan submits to God's plan and decides to fight for God's purpose, even if that means his own life is going to go a bit differently than he planned. I'll look at 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1. It says, after David finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. Verse 3, and Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his very cool belt. He's the son of the king. I mean, he has all of the best stuff. And he makes this covenant, this binding agreement with David, meaning Jonathan has formally allied himself with David. And then Jonathan gives David a bunch of gifts to symbolize their deep and lasting friendship. I thought it'd be kind of funny if I took off my belt and like gave it to Cliff, but then I thought better of it. So there is some stuff going on here culturally between these two guys that maybe seems a bit strange to us. I mean, they keep expressing their love and they're sharing clothes and all these things. So I thought if I could just translate this with a movie clip. This is a scene where a best man shows up at the wedding and makes a big public speech, just expressing his appreciation for his friendship with the groom. So speech is done, and then the groom responds.
I love you, man.
I love you too, bud.
I love you, dude.
I love you, bro Montana.
I love you, Holmes.
I love you, Broseph Goebbels.
I love you, Machacha.
I love you, Tico Brohe.
Okay. Okay. Hey. Let's continue here.
All right. I guess maybe you had to see the movie. But anyway, that's basically what's going on with David and Jonathan in this moment. Now, from here, things begin to rapidly unravel between David and Jonathan's dad, Saul. Things start to go off the rails a bit. Saul grows increasingly insecure about David's rising popularity. His jealousy over David, it escalates to the point where he starts trying to kill David. In 1 Samuel 19, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David, but make it look like an accident. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you." So Jonathan vows to help David. And the story goes on, and several times Jonathan attempts to vouch for David to his dad, like, "Dad, calm down." But King Saul doesn't listen. At one point, Saul throws a spear at Jonathan for attempting to stick up for his friend David and barely misses him. So the situation's ugly, and Jonathan realizes this is not going to end well. So Jonathan comes up with an elaborate plan to help David escape from his father's wrath. At this point, David's life is 100% in Jonathan's hands. David knows if Jonathan doesn't do what they planned, or worse, if it's a trap, he's dead. So they swear an oath to each other. They promise to always look out for each other and even their like future families someday, no matter what happens. David trusts his friend. Jonathan follows through and saves David's life. A little while later, they meet up after the whole thing kind of works out. Verse 41 of Samuel 20. David got up from the south side of the stone where he'd been hiding and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most because he's leaving because of the whole thing. He has to get out of town. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left and Jonathan went back to the town. Now, eventually Jonathan is killed in battle. And not long after that, his father Saul takes his own life to avoid being killed by the Philistines. Long story short, David becomes king. And there's a lot that happens and he has his hands full. But years later, David still hasn't forgotten about his pact with Jonathan. Now, we need to understand that in those days, whenever a new person with like a new bloodline took the throne, that it was customary for the new king to go through the land and look for any relatives of the past regime, the past bloodline. And so the new king would often gather all these relatives, people involved in the past bloodline, and either exile them or often actually kill them publicly. Because if you're the new king, you don't want trouble down the road from old king so-and-so's cousin or nephew or whatever showing up claiming the right to your throne. And so the new king would often wipe out the previous king's family to protect his rule, a little bit of insurance, and to establish his rule as the new ruler, a bit of a power move. This was done all the time in the ancient world. So Saul's gone. David is on the throne, and look what David does. In 2 Samuel chapter 9, David asked, "Is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" David remembers his promise to Jonathan. He asks if there are any survivors from the war and all these things, and he finds out that there is one. Ziba, who was the king's servant, answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet." Now, we're going to find out in a minute that Jonathan had named this son Mephibosheth, at which point I say if David was really as good of a friend as he said to Jonathan, he wouldn't have let him name him that. Verse 4, "Where is he?" the king asked. Ziba answered, "He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel in Lodabar." I think that's Bible for the absolute middle of nowhere. So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. So you have Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, grandson of Saul, literally the only surviving member of the former king's household. If you're Mephibosheth, you're not an assistant, you're not a distant cousin of Saul, you are his direct male descendant, which means you're a potential threat, which is perhaps why we find Mephibosheth living out in the wilderness. On top of that, his disability, which was mentioned in ancient times, that meant he had no way to provide for himself and was likely living in complete poverty. So you're Mephibosheth, and you get a knock at the door one day, and it's the new king's men. And oh yeah, by the way, King David demands to see you. What are you thinking? Well, yeah. You're thinking this is not good. You're thinking it's over. You're thinking it's only a matter of time before you lose your head. Look at verse 6. "When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, 'Mephibosheth, at your service,' he replied. 'Do not be afraid,' David said to him, 'for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, because of our friendship. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table.' So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons." He invites the son of his best friend, Jonathan, to eat at his table like his son. Because I think David knows, had it been the other way around, that Jonathan would have done the same for him. I just find it fascinating that the effects of their relationship, the ripple effects, extended, not only did it last Jonathan's life, it extended to the next generation even. So here's my question. Wouldn't you like to have a friend like that? Someone who, come hell or high water, is in your corner. See, some of us in this room are rich in lots of ways, maybe financially. Perhaps you are rich in independence. Maybe you're rich in entertainment options. But some of us are actually quite poor in friendship. And the reality is, friendship of any kind, and especially deep friendships, they don't just happen all by themselves. That friendships require vulnerability, intentionality, they require time, and of course, all of us are busy, and a lot of us are in a hurry, and a lot of us are losing the ability to be vulnerable and to risk being known. I would argue it's not that we're not willing to be vulnerable, it's that in many ways we no longer know how to do this or what it looks like. I mean, case in point, with the Jonathan story, there are some modern interpreters who look at their relationship. They see how close they were and how they openly expressed their love, and you know what conclusion they come to? Well, I guess then they must have been secret lovers. Like, we don't know where to put that. And I would argue that's a case of reading our culture onto the Bible, but at any rate, this kind of vulnerability and friendship doesn't just happen. Contributing to the problem, life in the digital age has dramatically shaped and changed our perspective on friendship. You ever sit in a restaurant? What's that word? Or a coffee shop, and you see people who are together, presumably, but all like looking down at their phones. And they're checking in with other people, and they're interacting with posts and friends who aren't even there. We've now come to the place where we have this weird app. We have this weird app on our phones that we never use, called our phone. Some of you, if you're younger especially, and your friend actually calls you, you are like, are you okay? And is this an emergency? And if not, why are you calling me? Several years ago, Facebook, which you may have heard of, released an ad on TV and online. And in the one-minute ad, there was a young woman sitting at a dinner table with, I guess, her family. And there's an older woman at the table, her mom, it could be an aunt. She begins talking about her day and something that happened at the grocery store. And noticeably bored, this young woman coyly pulls out her phone and proceeds to lose herself in Facebook notifications. First, a friend, picture of a friend playing the drums. Second, another friend dancing in a ballet. Third, some friends enjoying a day in the snow. And as she likes each photo, they all begin coming to life around her. The drumming, the dancing, the falling snowflakes, all having the effect of drowning out her mother's humdrum monologue. It's pretty compelling, but the point is clear. When real-life conversations get boring, I can pull out my phone and plunge myself into more interesting things. Of course, technology can be used for good. I know you're listening, Facebook. We can stay connected to people who move away. We can call our parents and catch up. We can get online and see if we're more successful than the people we went to high school with, even though we don't care about them. Oh, that was a negative one. But the dark side is this: we're so busy communicating with the digital world that we're squandering the opportunity to commune with like the real people in our midst. As the Roman philosopher Seneca says, to be everywhere is to be nowhere. Because of technology, we have the illusion of being more connected than we actually are. I mean, I can have 2,000 friends on social media and yet go to bed at night feeling like I actually don't really have any friends. As the famous sociologist Robert Bellah once observed, we are the generation that watches Friends without having any. And we think if we just show up at the coffee shop, everyone's just going to be there and magically, right, our life will be filled with meaningful connection. There are studies that show that because of texting and email and social media, that we are increasingly uncomfortable with face-to-face interaction. You think about meeting strangers or that awkward phase before friendship where you're just making small talk and trying to get to know each other. The thing is, when you text, when you respond to a Snapchat, you actually have time to think. I mean, hours later, you can send the perfectly crafted, clever response with just the right emoji or whatever. But it is not like that in face-to-face, real-time conversation. I have to tell you guys this crazy thing that happened to me. A couple of Saturdays ago, I was reading a book outside at Morrow's Meadow, that park, because Sabbath. Remember that? You can keep doing that. And they had these benches spread out every 100 yards or so right along the river, right by that path. And on this particular day, it was wide open. There was nobody there hardly, just a few people walking. And I brought a camping chair, and I set it right next to this bench because it's more comfortable. And I'm sitting there reading. I have I need you to understand this detail, a stack of books right here. And these two middle-aged women walk up with what had to have been like their elderly father, their older father. And they get kind of close, considering this. There's 30 acres here, right? And I thought, okay. But then, and I need you to hear this, listen to what happened. They proceed to sit down on the bench. Do you hear what I'm saying? The man's shoulder, I'm not exaggerating, we were almost touching. Complete strangers. And at first I had to look around like, is this a hidden camera show? Because again, there's a bench right just the farther down that's wide open. Why right here? And I didn't know what to do. It did seem rude to keep reading because it was weird. And it also seemed weird to be in their conversation. But then again, their proximity seemed to suggest that I was going to be a part of it whether I wanted to or not. But anyway, a very small part of me, very small. I actually kind of liked that they were that comfortable to sit next to a stranger, I mean, in the most awkward quiet. And we made a little small talk, and they mostly had their own conversation. And then after 10 excruciating minutes, they left. And I thought, that was kind of weird. So, I'm just saying. Sherry Turkle, in her book, Alone Together, she observed that on average, it takes about 7 minutes of face-to-face conversation for it to really get going. And for you introverts, that's like 7 minutes of torture. The first few minutes, she says, are often shallow, disjointed, and even boring. But in order to get to any level of meaning and connection, we have to remember, she says it this way, it's often in the moments when we stumble and hesitate and fall silent that we reveal ourselves to each other. In another one of her books, Reclaiming Conversation, she writes of these interviews she has with college students of the digital age who report overwhelmingly that unrehearsed, real-time conversation is something that makes me unnecessarily vulnerable. But to be vulnerable is precisely the point of conversation, because in vulnerability, we're actually truly known. But again, in our digital age, there's often no space. We don't give each other room to stumble, to hesitate. We don't give each other the grace of being helped back up, given time to regather our thoughts or re-engage in the dialogue. Meaningful friendship is forged slowly, with a lot of compromise and a little bit of awkwardness. And again, the challenge is we live in an impatient, shallow, isolated culture. I mean, the idea of involving myself in the messy work of forging meaningful friendships face-to-face over time It doesn't seem like an attractive option many times. And the digital age is standing by with a plethora of easier, quicker, shallower, and more individualistic options. And yet, one of the primary ways Jesus fulfilled his purpose, one of the primary ways he modeled to us what it looks like to be a whole human being, was through his face-to-face friendship with his disciples. He chose 12 guys, and he spent nearly every waking minute with them for 3 years. And there's a scene near the end of his life in ministry, and these guys have been together for a long time. They've been through all of these experiences that have bonded them together. They've traveled. They've slept out under the stars. They've walked along the road and talked. They've had these crazy moments of getting invited into strangers' houses. They've shared victories, and they've shared amazing experiences, and they've shared rejection and failure and defeat. And near the end of his life, he gets them all together, and he says, I need to tell you some things that I've never expressed. John 15, verse 12, he says, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. I think we sometimes miss this. We think of Jesus the Messiah, Jesus the teacher, Jesus the rabbi, Jesus in uniform. But we don't often think about Jesus as friend. We don't often think of Jesus going, hey, maybe you never shared this, but I just want you to know, I consider you my friends. I am honored to know you. I'm honored to lay down my life for you. And so what kind of friend was Jesus? And what can we learn about friendship from Jesus? Jesus shows us that friendship requires a lot of time. And again, our problem is we want instant connection. We want instant intimacy. We want instamacy. You're welcome. But some of you have had this experience where you met someone, maybe for the first time, you got together for coffee, and in that first meetup, you unloaded your whole story because you're desperate for friends, right? We want connection. We're all like this. But you told your struggles, and you dumped it all out there. And then it wasn't reciprocated, and you were hurt by that. Or maybe you ended up discovering that person was not a safe person. And the problem is you hadn't spent the time that it takes to build up trust. The relationship built on trust that Jesus and his disciples shared, that did not happen overnight. It was the result of lots of small moments, lots of small deposits of time that built up over time. I mean, you realize Jesus, he took 3 years before he fully revealed himself to the disciples. He didn't tell them everything at once. He didn't say on day one, now here's who I am, and here's what's going to happen. I mean, it would have been way too much for them. Because our time is limited, this means that we cannot have a deep relationship with everyone. And again, even Jesus didn't do that. Yes, we see him in the New Testament. He has different levels of friendships. You know, people like Nicodemus or some of the women who followed him. But then there was the 12. He spent most of his time with them. And then even of the 12, there were the three, Peter, James, and John, that he revealed more to them. He invested himself more intensely in them than even in the 12. And so it raises the question, how many people can I have a meaningful relationship with? How many real friendships can you actually sustain? It's less than 2,000 friends on your social media, right? Evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar, in a May article in The Atlantic, he talks about the number of meaningful and stable relationships you can have at any one time, and he includes family, extended family, and all your friends, so everybody in your life. And he says that on average, the number of relationships you can sustain is 150. And here's the key. He breaks the number down into different levels of connection. and therefore different amounts of time needed to maintain each level of relationship. And so he illustrates this with concentric circles. Starting in the middle, your smallest circle, but then the people that you're closest to. And then expanding out to include more and more people, but a diminishing level of closeness. So in the middle, you have your closest people, the people you're most intimate with. And the 1.5 is a little bit awkward. But think your spouse, your significant other, your lifelong best friend. The next layer up from here is your 5 shoulder to cry on friendships. I mean, these are the people who will drop everything when our world falls apart. The next level is the 15, kind of your main social circle, and it includes the 5, and these are people you enjoy life with, people you have fun with. This is oftentimes the category of people who are in your, like, we will exchange babysitting, meaning that they're people you trust your kids with. The 50 are your big weekend cookout people, that group. And then the 150 would be your wedding, funeral, once-in-a-lifetime kind of crew for those moments. And then you see beyond that, 500 are acquaintances, and then known names, 1,500. And then apparently we can all recognize 5,000 faces. Now, the closer you move to the middle, the more limited that group is. The more time it takes to sustain these relationships, and therefore the fewer deep relationships you can have. And I think that makes sense. Friendship, especially when you get in here, takes time. It requires availability. It requires being intentional. And we haven't even talked about the effect that these people can have on our lives and who we are and how they shape our lives. So that's next week. And boy, what would it look like to choose my friends wisely? Because that matters. Friendship takes time. Jesus shows us that true friendship requires mutual vulnerability. Friendship has this sense of being a mutual pursuit. Two people risk moving toward one another. Jesus sought the disciples. The disciples sought Jesus. This largely happened through face-to-face conversations. It was all the unplanned human moments that they shared. Think about all the hours of conversation and of interaction that they had that we're not told anything about. Walking along the road, eating together, fishing together, encountering detours and downtime and sharing stories. We know that Jesus gave them nicknames, right? He calls James and John the sons of thunder. And maybe when he said that, everyone just lost it. Like it was an inside joke. Like, trust me, you do not want to share a tent with those two. And even if that's not the case, you know they saw each other in their most vulnerable human moments. Again, Turkle, in her book, Reclaiming Conversation, she describes the way that texting and interacting online have threatened friendship because they allow us to plan and curate versions of ourselves that we present to others, that we're removed from facial expression and body language and tone of voice. That when we have time to consider and edit our replies, we actually don't face the risk that face-to-face conversations naturally bring. It enables us to not have to risk being known as less than perfect. Face-to-face, we are less predictable and less guarded. And so as inconvenient as it is sometimes, lending our whole-bodied presence to others matters a lot. To allow ourselves to be seen as we are, not as we wish others to see us. And when I say vulnerable, again, I just want to say not all at once and not even huge amounts of it right away. C.S. Lewis says, friendship is born at the moment when one person says to another, what? You too? I thought I was the only one. And maybe for David and Jonathan, it was David going, hey, don't take this the wrong way, but your dad has like an anger problem. And Jonathan's like, I think that all the time. Friendship begins with a small risk, with sharing, here's an insecurity. Here's something about me that's a little weird. And you've all heard the saying, the only normal people are those you don't know very well, right? It's, here's something that I'm a little bit self-conscious about, which then opens up the possibility for the other person to say, that's how I am too. So much of friendship comes from admitting the things that make you seem fragile when spoken out loud. The thing that's kind of cool about this is I said the thing, oh, I didn't tell you this. To move from like outer circle to the inner, to like the group of 5 or 15, that same psychologist said it takes about 200 hours to do that and not spread out over 10 years, right? So in a relatively short amount of time. And that's true because it takes time. The other thing that's cool about this, though, and this explains why you have cousins that you spent 200 hours with at least at family reunions and all that stuff, and you're still very much on the surface, and yet you meet someone else, and you have a moment like this. It's amazing how in an instant you can make significant progress toward having a deeper relationship. But here's what I want you to know. Friendship actually embodies the power of the gospel in a really unique way. What I'm saying is that in friendship, we live out the truth of the gospel to each other. I mean, what is the gospel besides the fact that Jesus knows how broken we are and yet sticks around and loves us anyway? What is friendship besides someone who knows another person who knows how broken we are and sticks around to love us anyway? And again, conversation is the beginning of all this. It's the place where we become known. Justin Early, in his book on spiritual practices, he actually includes friendship as a practice. And we're going to talk more about that later. But he says, vulnerability and time turn people who have a relationship into people who have a friendship. That's what friendship is. Vulnerability across time. Which means when it comes to friends, we need to practice courage and prioritize our time. As far as time, this is about ordering our time to be more intentional and available to those life-giving relationships. It probably means investing in fewer relationships. If it's true that millennials spend, because we say we don't have time for this, we spend 5.5 hours a day on our phone, I would bet that much of that time is spent cultivating the outer circles, you know, more than the 150 for a lot of us. My wife goes on a walk almost weekly with a friend, and because of their morning schedules, they do this crazy early in the morning. But they value that, and so they make time to connect. I have a friend who lives in India, and because of our schedules, we don't see each other very often, and 2 or 3 times a year, and we got to really make this happen and a lot of back and forth to nail down a date well in advance to meet up at Mounds to go for a walk or to meet somewhere for breakfast. It's about having that standing coffee appointment to get together face to face or sharing a meal. For the friend that's far away, it's making time for that phone call once in a while or regularly to stay connected. And so the question for you is, what friendship in your life do you need to prioritize a bit more with time? And then for courage, if you're like me, it is very easy to make our friendships all about just hanging out, fun, surface, shared activities, and that's it. What would it look like for you the next time you got together if you were just to take a little bit of a risk and share what was really going on? To share where maybe you don't have it all together as well as you project. In what close relationship could you exercise a bit more courage in order to be fully known? And you will be amazed at how your courage and your small risk opens up the door and creates all kinds of space for this other person to say, yeah, that I'm like that too. I've been thinking about friendship in a different way. Thinking about it as little fires. Let's see if that comes up. Okay, it's not going to come up, but picture a fire. You've seen one before. There you go. that fire being a symbol for warmth and for light. And this idea of tending fires, that every time you're vulnerable, every time you let your real self be seen, every time you take a small risk and a little bit more self-disclosure, you're throwing another stick on that fire. Every time you make time in your busy schedule to get together and have a meaningful conversation, you're adding to the fire. And it's worth it. So my question is what fires do you need to tend? As you think about the circles, the concentric circles moving to our close relationships, what fires do you need to tend? In his book, A Million Miles in a Thousand Years, Donald Miller tells a story of Jim and Janice, and Janice had been diagnosed with cancer, and she did not live long after her diagnosis. And after her funeral, all the family and all these people who knew and loved her, they all got together, and they shared memories, and they shared stories of Janice. And Miller writes, reflecting on that experience, "I wondered how much it cost to be rich in friends, and how many years and stories and scenes it takes to make a rich life happen. You can't build an end scene as beautiful as this by sitting on the couch." No, you can't. And so if this is you, start now. Build a rich life by developing a few deep friendships. Would you stand and we'll pray? Heavenly Father, we acknowledge that there are so many reasons why this is hard for us. We feel like we don't have time. Maybe more honestly, it just feels risky to reach out in this way, to essentially open ourselves up to the possibility of even rejection. But Lord, we know that you have created us for a few deep friendships, and maybe a circle beyond that, and really, we're not meant to be friends with thousands of people. So Lord, help us to be a community that does friendship well as we kind of grow in this and talk about it the next several weeks. Lord, for some of us, perhaps you put on our hearts that one friend, that one relationship, and we have not done a very good job of tending that fire. So help us to reach out with our time and our presence and courage. Lord, help us to grow in this and to come to see that friendship is a key way you want to form us and make us more like your son. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, as you go, I just want to remind you, the volunteer board, it's going to be hard to miss when you walk out. So check it out, maybe find a description or two, and see if there's not a place for you to plug in. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday. Surely as the stars above me.
deeper than the sea. Oh, oh. One love will be forever greater than my.